This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, November 2nd, 2007. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns. In today's program, Day of the Dead celebrations in Oaxaca are marred by clashes between police and protesters. Hollywood screenwriters have announced intentions to strike. And demonstrators in Washington, D.C. protest a new U.S. anti-narcotics agreement with Mexico. All this and more, but first, these news headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. Burma's military junta has handed expulsion orders to the top United Nations official there. The letter comes after the diplomat's office issued statements encouraging the junta to listen to pro-democracy protesters. The expulsion comes just one day before UN Special Envoy Ibrahim Gambari returns to Burma for a six-day visit. Rebels from Uganda's notorious Lord's Resistance Army are in the capital, Kampala, holding talks with members of parliament in the first of a series of meetings across the country. Joshua Chalimpa reports.
The meetings are part of the ongoing peace talks between the rebels and the government, mediated by officials from South Sudan. It is the first time the rebels or their representatives have publicly stepped foot in the Ugandan capital since launching war against the government 21 years ago. The rebels hope to meet the president before proceeding to the north of the country to discuss justice and reconciliation for atrocities committed there. Joshua Chalimpa, FSRN, Kampala.
A new study has found that 1 in 8 of America's 47 million people who lack health insurance is a veteran or member of a veteran's household. Kelly Ramirez has the story.
A study by Harvard Medical School researchers showed that 12.7% of non-elderly veterans were uninsured in 2004, up from 9.9% in 2000. The Veterans Health Care Eligibility Reform Act of 1996 opened VA health care to all veterans, but in January of 2003, just before the invasion of Iraq, the Department of Veterans Affairs halted the enrollment of most middle-income veterans. Others are unable to obtain VA care due to waiting lists at some VA facilities, unaffordable co-payments for VA specialty care, or the lack of VA facilities in their communities. Dr. David Himmelstein, an associate professor at the Harvard Medical School, is the lead researcher for the study.
I was first surprised to learn that there were uninsured veterans at all. I found that out when I started seeing some uninsured veterans in my practice, and that's when we started to look at the statistics. And I was surprised to see that the number is going up, and going up pretty substantially.
Dr. Himmelstein, who is also a founder of Physicians for a National Health Program, says national health insurance is the answer for veterans and all Americans. For FSRN, I'm Kelia Ramirez.
Meteorologists predict that Hurricane Noel will largely spare the eastern seaboard this weekend, aside from heavy rainfall in some areas. The hurricane is currently located between the Bahamas and the coast of North Carolina. Flooding and mudslides triggered by Noel, when she was still only a tropical storm, killed more than 115 people in Haiti and the Dominican Republic. In other climate news, citizens from across the U.S. will hold events and rallies around the country tomorrow to urge lawmakers to take action to curb global warming. The Step It Up campaign is calling for a moratorium on new coal plants, an 80% reduction in carbon emissions by the year 2050, and for the creation of 5 million new green jobs. Meanwhile, some 100 mayors from cities across the U.S. are in Seattle today to discuss measures to combat climate change and reduce greenhouse gas emissions at the local level. And finally, in the latest wave of violence in Nigeria's volatile Niger Delta region, militants have attacked a Navy ship protecting oil installations in the area. Samuel Okoye reports from Lagos.
An attack launched earlier this week by the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta killed a naval officer and injured four others. The Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta is the main militant group in the volatile region. The group said in a statement that the attack was to prove to the Nigerian government and multinational oil companies operating in the region that the Nigerian military cannot protect oil facilities. The group said oil facilities can only be free from its attacks when local communities have justice. Some militant groups in the Niger Delta say they took up arms so that local communities can have a share of crude oil proceeds from the area. The billions of dollars in annual profit are normally shared between the Nigerian government and multinational oil companies operating in the region, while local residents live in grinding poverty. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
And those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
After a period of relative calm, social unrest has once again erupted in the Mexican state of Oaxaca. At least 20 people were arrested today when hundreds of state and local police descended on an intersection where protesters were building a traditional Day of the Dead altar. The intersection was the site of a seven-hour street battle fought 1 year ago today between federal riot police and anti-government demonstrators. Vladimir Flores takes a look at the intersection between social unrest and tradition as Oaxaca enters into a weekend of customary festivities.
Day of the Dead is the most important day of the year in Oaxaca. It's a time when people build decorative altars and sand paintings to honor the dead. Neighborhood residents participate in street celebrations to welcome home the spirits of loved ones. But below the festive surface of the Day of the Dead celebrations is a continuing clamor for justice for the more than 23 people killed in last year's popular uprising here. Individuals who participated in last year's protests took over a major intersection early this morning to construct a traditional altar to those killed in the uprising. This woman, who did not want to give her name, describes what happened.
Hoy a las 6 de la mañana pensábamos hacer un tapete para...
At 6 o'clock this morning, we were thinking about making a sand painting in memory of our fallen compañeros and to remember our compañeros who were imprisoned and tortured. There are about 40 of us there when all of a sudden the ministerial and state police special forces arrived in trucks and with plainclothes police on motorcycles. The trucks came into the intersection with violence, coming at us if they were going to run us over, and they were mostly going after the youth who were there at the time. They took away many of the young people and the teachers. Large quantities of police arrived afterwards. They are checking everybody who passes by in private vehicles.
Neighborhood residents also complained that police were carrying out house-to-house searches for young people who fled on foot. Cinco Señores is a major intersection near the State University. 1 year ago today, thousands of members of the Popular Assembly of the People of Oaxaca and neighborhood residents successfully fought a seven-hour street battle against federal riot police who had come to tear down barricades protecting the university and its radio station. The federal police came with water cannons and combat helicopters. The demonstrators had rocks and Molotov cocktails. The street battle has come to be known as the All Saints Victory. It came just 5 days after thousands of federal police took over the city to stamp out an uprising against the governor. The pretext for the federal intervention was to maintain order after armed groups loyal to the ruling party attacked three large barricades maintained by anti-government protesters. Miguel Cruz of the Indigenous Popular Council of Oaxaca, CIPO, witnessed the attack on the Calicanto barricade on October 27th of last year.
The authorities ordered their hitmen to attack the barricades in Calicanto, La Experimental, and Santa Maria Coyotepec, resulting in the assassination of the New York indie media journalist Brad Will and the dozens wounded from bullets and beatings and kidnappings. Brad Will's murder was the argument the federal and state government used to justify sending thousands of militarized police to Oaxaca on October 29th to sow fear, pain, and death in the men and women who were asking for justice.
While federal police were able to stifle the protest calling for the governor's resignation, tension and anger have continued to boil below the surface. A few protesters remain in prison for their participation in last year's uprising, yet all of the murders of demonstrators have gone unpunished. To Father Manuel Arias, this type of impunity ensures that unrest will continue.
I think that it's obvious to everyone that the root problems in Oaxaca remain unresolved. And as long as they go unresolved, popular protests will continue to seethe. because the people can no longer tolerate the oppression which has already reached its limit. And now a new age has begun of resistance to everything that tries to take away the urge for freedom.
In light of today's arrests, the Section 22 Teachers Union has called for a march this afternoon and for emergency meetings to determine what actions to take in the coming days. For FSRN, I am Vladimir Flores in Oaxaca.
The Mexican and U.S. governments have negotiated a new anti-narcotics aid package that would send over $1 billion in financial and military assistance to Mexico. The money is earmarked to fight Mexican drug cartels and drug trafficking between both countries. Critics of the plan converged today at the Mexican embassy in Washington, D.C. They're calling for an end to the U.S. bankrolling of the Mexican military. Catherine Jarmel reports from the U.S. Capitol.
President Bush and Mexican President Felipe Calderón agreed on a new anti-narcotics aid package that will send over $1 billion to Calderón's government to fight drug production in Mexico. The two administrations have been discussing this package since March. Bush included $500 million of initial funding for the initiative in the Iraq supplemental funding request sent to Congress last week. The Merida initiative has been called Plan Mexico by critics. This name likens it to Plan Colombia, the anti-narcotics aid package that has cost the United States more than $5 billion over the past 7 years. Critics who oppose the initiative met today at the Mexican embassy, asking for an end to human rights abuses by the Mexican government. This group called for a new investigation into the death of Brad Will, a social justice activist and indie media videographer who was killed while filming the teachers' strike in Oaxaca. Although Will's final footage contains images of men shooting at him, a document leaked this week from the Office of Mexico's Attorney General of the Republic implied that the gunmen in Will's footage were not responsible for his death. The as-of-yet-unsubstantiated report says the shots that killed Will were fired at a closer range. Harry Bubbins is an organizer for a group called Friends of Brad. Bubbins says he opposes the aid to Mexico because it will fund police violence in the region.
Well, it's been a year since Brad Will was murdered in Oaxaca, Mexico, and now the Bush administration has floated a $1.5 billion Plan Mexico, which would arm with helicopters, military vehicles, and greater surveillance capabilities the very same Mexican military and police that are responsible for his murder.
Sanjo Tree, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, describes how the Merida Initiative and other counter-narcotics programs failed to affect the power of the drug cartels.
We can't hope to win a war on drugs when our policies see to it that only the most efficient operations survive. And not only do they survive, but they thrive because we've done two things unintentionally to help them. Number one, we've eliminated their competition for them. We've picked off the inefficient drug traffickers, the clumsy ones. And number two, we've artificially tried to constrict the supply of drugs available on the streets while the demand remains the same, thereby driving up drug prices and drug profits for the cartels.
State Department spokesman Rob McInturf says the initiative is being worked on, but technological improvements and focused planning will make the initiative successful.
This is going to target the big cartels. It's going to target the small cartels. It's going to target everybody. There are criticisms out there, and I think the people that are working out the details of this are keenly aware of the criticisms and are looking to focus the resources as much as they can on a broad swath to get the big and the small, try to make the region safer for both sides.
While addressing the Mexican Congress on Tuesday, Mexico's Attorney General Eduardo Medina Mora says Mexico needs the U.S. to focus on helping end drug trafficking by targeting American citizens who aid trafficking by assisting with border arms sales, the transport of drug manufacturing chemicals, and money laundering. The House Committee on Foreign Affairs will host a hearing this month to discuss the Merida Initiative. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Catherine Jarmel in Washington, D.C.
Hollywood writers have pronounced that they intend to call a strike. The leadership of the Writers Guild of America made the announcement last night after contract negotiations with studios hit an impasse. At issue is how writers should be compensated for digital distribution of their work. The Guild's contract expired Wednesday. If a deal is not reached over the weekend, the walkout could begin as early as Monday, affecting talk shows and other topical programming immediately. Leilani Albano has more on the story.
The Writers Guild of America West, which represents 12,000 movie and television writers, say that writers are not being properly compensated for work appearing on DVDs, as well as on websites, cell phones, and other emerging technologies. The union's previous contract expired on October 31. Jeff Hermanson is Assistant Executive Director of the union.
This is the first negotiations in which we will make a strong push to cover all of new media content that is produced by our members, and we expect to have quite a difficult time with that.
Profits from internet and new media income continue to soar, with each of the six production conglomerates generating $500 million to $1 billion a year. Hermanson says writers are asking for a 2.5% share.
This industry would not be the dynamic, powerful industry that it is without the contribution of writers, and therefore we feel fully justified in seeking what we consider to be a reasonable percentage of the revenue that's earned on our content.
In response, the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers is rejecting any increase in payments based on DVD sales and only wants to place a study on digital media sales. Nick Counter, president of the AMPT, had this to say in a written statement. Due to overriding business reasons, no further progress can be made because of the WGA's continuing efforts to substantially increase the DVD formula. We are ready to meet at any time and remain committed to reaching a fair and reasonable deal that keeps the industry working, but the DVD issue is a roadblock to these negotiations. Muffy Sunday, who is an organizer with Radical Women, says the results of the writers' contract negotiations will have a large impact on work conditions.
Every day we see the results of our unions not taking a very aggressive stand to bargain and represent the work that's moved electronically, on the internet, all of that. And if they don't fight to represent their members who are now working more and more in an industry that's moving away from the standard, they're not only dead as a union, but this entire huge workforce is going to be unrepresented and work in sweatshop conditions.
In order to win the strike, organizers say other unions must take united efforts to support the writers, but so far have failed to do so. Teamsters Local 399, which represents Hollywood's casting directors, location managers, and truck drivers, and the Screen Actors Guild, state that a no-strike provision in their contracts prohibits them from a work stoppage, but say individual workers can choose to honor the writers' picket lines if they wish. Joe Kaplan is the attorney for Local 399.
There's nothing that we can do about it. We are contractually limited to that.
Winning the fight over internet sales can make a big difference in the lives of writers, who are averaging $40,000 to $50,000 in annual salaries, but often find themselves jobless several months a year. Hermanson says they will need the added income to make ends meet during the long unemployment spells.
Quite often, because of the insecurity of this occupation, you know, you go from feast to famine, depend on residual income, which is very often a cushion between terms of employment.
Rather than give in to the writers' demands, studios have sped up production over the past months on movie sets and television sets as a way to strike-proof their shows, says Hermanson.
Well, it's employer resistance is always the difficulty. You know, they don't want to pay what they don't have to pay, and our people don't want to do the work unless they're fairly compensated, so it's going to be a tussle.
Huge profits from new media sales aren't the only reason executives aren't budging. With reality shows like American Idol dominating primetime programming, Hollywood executives have another reason not to give into the guild's demands. Hermanson predicts executives will increasingly defer to reality programming and its largely non-union staff as a means to fill the airwaves. But he says that tactic may soon falter now that writers for reality shows like America's Next Top Model are beginning to assert their rights. The show made headlines last July when its writing staff became the first reality show writers to go on strike. Their efforts may have failed, but they are proving to Hollywood that reality show writers are willing to join others in their struggle for better treatment, says Hermanson.
The networks, you know, like to threaten us that if we go on strike, they'll put reality television on the air. But I do believe there's a limit to that, and that they can't be so sure that the reality writers and other folks involved in the production of reality television will consent to be used as pawns in a strike.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leilani Albano in Los Angeles.
Presidential politics went on the offensive this week. During an NBC debate, Democratic candidates ratcheted up pressure on frontrunner Hillary Clinton. She has become the target of some campaigns and has responded that politics is an all-men's club. Barack Obama is the latest to join the post-debate maneuvering. Speaking on the morning show today, he said, "I am assuming and I hope that Senator Clinton wants to be treated like everybody else, and I think that's why she's running for president." But this tit-for-tat is leaving many people wondering where the issues went. Matt Laszlo has this week's political roundup.
The debate solidified Clinton's position as the frontrunner and also showed she has some weaknesses. About half of the questions were about Clinton and her positions.
You said that Senator Clinton was trying to sound Republican, trying to vote Republican.
What double talk are you suggesting that Senator Clinton's been engaging in on Iran?
That was NBC's Brian Williams and Tim Russert asking Senators Barack Obama and John Edwards about Clinton. But the hosts were generous enough to let Clinton respond with another question about Clinton.
You stand behind the word double talk.
I do.
Senator Clinton.
No new positions came out of the debate. New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson still wants an immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich still wants a Department of Peace. And Senators Chris Dodd and Joseph Biden still oppose Clinton for supporting a resolution that calls the Iranian Revolutionary Guard a terrorist organization. But the debate was a turning point. Gone are the quiet, peaceful debates where everyone talks about their positions on pressing issues like health care and Iraq. It seems the remaining debates will now be more like boxing matches, only with words.
I want to add something that Chris Dodd just said a minute ago, because I don't want it to go unnoticed. Unless I missed something, Senator Clinton said two different things in the course of about 2 minutes.
That was Edwards talking about Clinton's position on whether to give driver's licenses to undocumented workers in New York. Edwards was referring to this exchange.
Well, Senator, that's
I just want to add, I did not say that it should be done, but I certainly recognize why Governor Spitzer is trying to do it,
and we have failed.
We have failed.
No. You said yes. No. You thought it made sense to do it.
No, I didn't, Chris, but the point is...
And Obama couldn't resist this one either.
Well, I was confused on Senator Clinton's answer. I can't tell whether she was for it or against it.
Later in the week, in response to the attacks... Clinton donned a pair of red boxing gloves. But the one who might need the gloves most is former Alaska Senator Mike Gravel. NBC didn't even invite him to the debate because he hasn't raised enough money. Gravel cried foul, but the refs seem not to have listened. Kucinich has also been getting flack for one of his answers. Russert asked him about a UFO that Shirley MacLaine says they saw together.
Did you see a UFO?
I did, and the rest of the account, it was unidentified flying object, okay? It's unidentified. I saw something now.
So, presidential candidates are supposed to call the watchtower after they see anything moving in the sky? Another group also got criticized this week. Reporters. According to the Project for Excellence in Journalism, the campaign coverage has been focused on five candidates. Clinton and Obama on the Democratic side, and Rudy Giuliani, John McCain, and Mitt Romney on the Republican side. The new study shows that Giuliani, McCain, and Clinton have received the most negative coverage, while Obama and Republican Fred Thompson have been media darlings, receiving mostly positive press. And as the candidates ratchet up their inter-party bickering, those numbers don't seem to be changing anytime soon. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
7 years ago, the Federal Communications Commission recognized the need for more diversity in programming on the radio airwaves. The FCC began taking applications for new low-power FM stations, but the new broadcasting window was immediately closed due to lobbying by powerful corporate radio interests, educational institutions, labor unions, churches, towns, and community groups seeking to start low-power radio stations have faced restrictive license requirements that limit community access to airwaves. But there is new hope this week. The Senate Commerce Committee has approved the Local Community Radio Act. The legislation is designed to ease licensing restrictions enough to allow for hundreds of new non-commercial stations. FSRN's Andalusia Knoll has more.
KOCZ is a low-power FM radio station in Opelousas, Louisiana that broadcasts much-needed housing and emergency assistance information during Hurricane Katrina.
KOCZ,
103.7 FM, Opelousas, Louisiana.
Normally, KOCZ serves as an outlet for local Zydeco music and community news. Director John Freeman believes that accessible media is a vital aspect of democracy.
It's important to have low-power stations across the country. And because it supports our democracy, if we don't have an ability to communicate with our community, then we really don't have much to offer to our democracy in this United States.
Low-power FM radio stations can also play a central role in grassroots organizing. With the help of the Prometheus Radio Project, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, a group of immigrant farm workers in South Florida fighting for better wages, started the LPFM station Radio Conciencia. According to Romeo Ramirez, their radio station, which broadcasts in indigenous Guatemalan languages, Creole, and Spanish, has played a central role in their fight against corporate fast food giants unwilling to pay any more than slave wages to the farm workers who grow their tomatoes.
It's a platform where we can transmit the voice of the people, a media to communicate what the reality is. Media that gives people the opportunity to develop and transmit messages about human rights and the basic rights of the immigrant community, where there are abuses at work or discrimination.
Kate Blofson, an organizer with the Prometheus Radio Project, explains how large broadcasters blocked the FCC ruling on the expansion of low-power radio in 2000.
Very shortly after it was introduced, the National Association of Broadcasters and NPR began lobbying Congress to limit LPFM because of interference concerns. What that resulted in was Congress passing a law limiting low-power FM very significantly. Over 60% of applications were thrown out, including any possibility for LPFMs in major urban markets.
Though a 2003 study showed no interference can be expected, LPFM's opponents continue to use this argument to prevent licensing of more channels on the dial for new radio stations. Russ Withers, spokesperson for the National Association of Broadcasters, appeared before the Senate Commerce Committee on Tuesday to repeat that, quote, broadcasters have serious concerns with introducing thousands of micro radio stations to the FM band. Northern Minnesota's Boundary Waters radio station is one of many LPFM initiatives prevented from going on the air by FCC regulations that prevent them from using available radio channels. Mary Sish says that they have broad community support, but still cannot obtain a license.
The current restrictions make it absolutely impossible for us to broadcast to, you know, the people of our town of Ely, and we've actually collected nearly 1,000 signatures from people in the area that say they want us to have a license, and we still have not been able to get a license. And we're in a town of 3,700 people, so 1,000 signatures is a large amount for this area.
With wide congressional support, the Local Community Radio Act is set to clear this obstacle. Mike Doyle, congressman representing Western Pennsylvania, is one of 55 co-sponsors of the bill.
We think that low-power FM offers local communities the opportunity to do important community programming. And, we're talking about limited, low-range, low-power FM radio, but it's done a lot of good in a lot of areas.
In the coming months, legislative versions of the Local Community Radio Act will appear before the Senate and House of Representatives. If it passes, the airwaves in almost every major city and small town in the United States will be opened up to hundreds or even thousands of new community-based low-power FM radio stations. For Free Speech Radio News, from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, I'm Andalusia Null.
Podcasts and transcripts of Free Speech Radio News can be found online at www.fsrn.org. There, listeners can also comment on the day's stories and participate in discussion forums. That's online at fsrn.org. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.